This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's become a holiday tradition here on the State of Things to spotlight the people who make this show happen. State of Things producers are usually too busy working behind the scenes to come out and take a bow, but we do carve out this time to help you get to know them a little better. So now I'd like you to meet Grant Holub-Mormon. Hello, Grant.
Hello, Frank.
Good to have you here. And of course, you grew up just down the road in Chapel Hill, and I know you've got a personal history of the state, but there's still a lot to learn, right?
So one of the aspects of the state that I didn't get a lot of exposure to as a kid was military culture in this state, which is a huge part of what makes North Carolina, North Carolina. Fort Bragg in particular, I got to learn a lot about. We invited some folks in from Fort Bragg to talk about a conservation effort that they're doing at the base. Let's take a listen.
So on Fort Bragg, a lot of people don't realize it's the largest military installation in the world based on personnel trained. So there's 55,000 active duty soldiers that need to maintain a state of readiness at all times. And so we have four impact areas. They encompass 33,000 acres, so it's a large chunk of land. Around the perimeter of these four impact areas, we have 83 fixed ranges and live fire ranges. And then outside of there, we have various artillery firing points. And the sole purpose of these areas is to be a restricted space to receive munitions. So daily, they're shot into anything from a 155 millimeter artillery shell down to a small M4. And so again, Brian referenced the tracers and the pyrotechnic type incendiary devices. Those all start fires, and so daily you're getting the vegetation's shot up, it's burned, and so it creates that disturbance that the butterfly thrives on.
So that was John Garrow, the Range Operations Training Lands Coordinator at Fort Bragg. Anita Rao spoke with him, as well as Brian Ball and Nick Haddad, who are doing really important conservation work at the military base.
And did he say something about butterflies?
Yeah, he's laying out this scenario, this ecosystem of a artillery range. And on this artillery range exists one of the world's rarest butterflies. But it's kind of signifier of this larger ecosystem that requires consistent fires to be maintained. It requires beaver dams, requires all these variables that can only exist on a piece of land that is being shot at and that doesn't have logging occurring on it, logging or farming. So it's this really interesting scenario of a military base taking on conservation work that I just found fascinating.
Well, Grant, one of the segments that you chose as your favorites from this past year was a total lecture. Set this one up for us.
Yeah, so I mean, this was a professor coming in to kind of detail a part of history that we don't learn about so much in North Carolina public schools. This was the Tuscarora War. And I learned a lot about the Lost Colony. I learned a lot about the Revolutionary and Civil Wars. I learned almost nothing about the Tuscarora War. And this is a really important war to understanding our cultural identity, to understanding how colonization happened, to understand where people went who were here before. And so we talked with Arwin Smallwood, who's a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T University, and he really dug into this history with us.
Tuscaroras were Iroquoian people, and they were connected to the Five Nations, or what became known as the Iroquois Confederacy. The native name is Haudenosaunee, is what they're called. And their origins, of course, are in the Mississippi River Valley. They say orally that they pretty much started at the ancient city of Cahokia. They migrated east, what we call the Five Nations, the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas, settled in New York State, what is today New York State. And they still have reservations in Western New York State and some in Canada, and that's another story. They split during the Revolution. The Tuscaroras branched off from them during that migration east, and they headed into North Carolina. And they ended up following the river systems, the Roanoke in particular, down into eastern North Carolina, and then began to settle in eastern North Carolina along the mouths of all of the major rivers, pretty much from the Roanoke River down to the Cape Fear. Before the war, they had petitioned the governor of Pennsylvania as early as 1708, 1709, to leave North Carolina because of conflicts with the colonists, particularly the kidnapping of their women and children and selling of them into slavery. And that was a major complaint that the Tuscaroras had against the colonists moving down from Virginia into eastern North Carolina. And they wanted to go and settle with their kin in the north, whom they had maintained a great relationship and trading partnership with and military alliance with for many years prior to the arrival of Europeans.
I want to continue with Professor Smallwood's segment on Tuscarora history in just a second, but I do want to share a bit about why this segment was so exciting for me to produce. One of the big lessons that I've learned on this show is that just being interested and thoroughly read on a topic doesn't always make the radio magic. And as media makers and educators, we want that magic, those sparks that pull you into a topic and away from your own preconceptions. I love talking with scholars and scientists, but what really brings these topics alive is a personal connection.
What about the conversations in your family, in that community, in terms of identification? How did you identify, and was there much conversation about these other identities and cultures that were historically part of your own?
It was just understood. We were family. You know, everybody was family. People had been from that community for hundreds of years. Like I said, going back at, you know, before slavery, but since slavery, both my mother's family and my father's family, churches were established at the end of slavery. And so all of the people are buried at the church. Prior to that, you know, my grandfather would take me through the landscape, and there are slave cemeteries and there are Indian burial grounds. And so he would show me where the slave cemeteries and Indian burial grounds were. It was just understood we were family. So it was never, you know, people considered themselves, because that's how the state of North Carolina identified people, as, you know, colored people, as, you know, Negroes or African Americans. But if you go through census records and you look at early census records, you'll see that many of the people were referred to, particularly before the 1930 census, but the 1920, 1910, as mulattoes. And we also know that if you're using the term mulatto, that means a mix. And oftentimes, if you go way back to colonial times, you'll know that mulatto was often used to describe mixes between Indians and blacks, as well as Indians and whites. It was kind of a universal catchphrase before we moved to Negro. And so, and I say this to folks quite candidly, we look at Bertie County, if we look at our state, and we look at the, and it's similar with Virginia as well, but if you look at the history of our state, especially with DNA today, you will find that many people who are native North Carolinians, who can trace their ancestry back to this era, to the 1600s and 1700s, whether they're white, black, or Native American, they're going to have some combination of all three heritages. And that's not even talking about culturally, in terms of the foods that we eat and our basic behaviors and the ways in which we act, how much Native people have influenced all of the peoples in the state of North Carolina.
Is there a way to go back now and kind of pull the threads apart and find out the impact of that influence? I mean, again, we absolutely dismiss the powerful diplomatic and sophisticated diplomatic and trade relations that Native tribes and groups had. The Confederacy so impressed Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, that he thought our Constitution should be based on their Confederacy. So clearly a sophisticated diplomatic and trade system. How much of it can we, because we, and we tell ourselves the story that thank God we got here and imposed some order on this thing, because it was a mess.
Well,
can we tell now?
Well, actually, nothing could be further from the truth. Oftentimes, scholars will argue, well, no, our form of government and our democracy is, you know, based in Europe, you know, it's based, you know, but you have to understand that at the time of exploration, we were in a period of absolute monarchies, and they did not believe in democracy. So where did even the concept of democracy in the Americas come from? Native people had a democracy. And everyone, you know, they operated in consensus. So people had to have a consensus before they did anything. We learned foods from them, tobacco. We learned the Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash, and white potatoes. We learn all these things from them and incorporate them into our daily lives, but we don't pay attention to their political structures and their systems.
That was Arwin Smallwood, a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T University and one of Grant Hall of Mormon's pick for this year. We're performing our annual ceremony of checking in with the show's producers and hearing about their favorite programs of the year. And Grant, you're a performer at heart. How do you feel about our live events?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really special opportunity to take something that is generally a broadcast form. We're sending this out into the world, and instead offer the guests themselves the opportunity to meet and extend those conversations after the show. And so we do this monthly show at Greensboro. We do a couple other kind of events throughout the state, and we're hoping to do more of that. And I think this is a really special opportunity to make radio into a sort of theatrical event. This next favorite of mine continues the conversation that Professor Smallwood started and became a really special moment when Ione Jeffries, who's an Afro-Native woman of the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, actually offered a song to us.
So the song is titled Makchi, which is performed by Ulali?
Ulali.
Ulali. And what's Pure Faye. Yes. She wrote She's the composer. Yeah.
And Lawrence Dunmore translated it.
Yes. And Lawrence Dunmore is our cousin. Yeah. I'm part of the Okinichi tribe as well. So it translates to, 100 years have passed, yet I hear the distant beat of my father's drum. His beat I feel within my heart. The drum shall beat, so my heart shall beat, and I shall live 1,000 years. Makchi tamboi apikiri, makchi tamboi kanspewa ebe, makchi tamboi apikiri, makchi tamboi kanspewa ebe mapewa, hokaye mong. Ta on ta ni kai tae giwe me itai na kaya yamuni e wajitse na kaya yamuni e wajitse na kaya yamuni e wajitse.
That was Ione Jeffries, an organizer for Alamance County's first ever Indigenous Peoples Day celebration this past year, and she's a member of the Okinichi Band of the Saponi Nation.
Grant Hollab-Moorman, producer on The State of Things, sharing his favorites on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more to come. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and it's that time of year again. We're taking down the lights, eating lots of leftovers, and dragging out our producers in the studio to tell us about their favorite episodes of the year. Today, I'm talking to the newest and youngest member of the team, Grant Hollab-Moorman. Grant, we didn't mention yet the fact that this is really your first year here.
Yeah, I haven't been here for long, about 6 months, and I've learned a couple things. I mean, there are two kinds of journalists out there, Frank. They're the ones with the neat desks with the post-it notes in a line, and they're the ones with everything strewn in piles of paper about a foot high. I do find myself in the latter part of that category. Mm-hmm. I've really tried to accelerate the entropy at my desk, but I'm still playing catch-up.
You're in the Carl Malden end of the spectrum.
Absolutely.
Well, that's fine. A couple of weeks before we opened up the position, actually, you were a guest on the program. How about that for a transition?
I was. I was sitting in the seat right next to you, Frank, and I will say that's a frightening seat to be in because your wild gestures, which listeners might not encounter unless they've been to one of our live shows, they can create some collateral damage.
A little bit of mayhem. So talk about why you were on the program.
So I came on the program as a finalist in the Southern Oral History Program's annual competition called Sonic South, where they give a curated list of interviews that they've taken from their archive, and they ask audio makers, musicians, to take a whack at them and pretty much creatively reimagine these sort of static interviews that they've been holding on to.
Well, let's hear a bit of that audio piece and then our interview back then before we get to this interview right now.
How would you assist a woman in labor?
Well, some of them are so contrary you couldn't hardly help them. I went and sat down one time. I said, just go ahead. I said, I shall not touch you till you get to where you can abide by what I tell you.
My mother had lost one child previously before birth prematurely. So when she had this one, to be sure, because she wanted to be sure everything's okay, she had the doctor to come down. Now,
Chihuahua County has not had a lot of midwives in recent time because the physicians weren't all that enthusiastic. And because the people have access, with Medicaid, they got access to the physicians. Well, as I say, I've never known a white midwife.
I'm going to put this one on here, but I'm not going to use the doctor's names. But this is what is known to have happened or said to have happened. Midwives would always, when she finished, which is she's going to give you a little longer navel than normal.
After the baby is born, well, you cut the navel cord. I always tied mine twice and then cut between the ties. And then if you did that, well, they used to scorch cloths and put on it. That scorched cloth would heal it up quick, you know.
Not the little tight end neighbor. You're going to have a little long stick out neighbor. Huh?
An Audi,
yeah. When he came down there, he saw this and he said it was too long. So he then went to reach up on my mother's counter and get a pair of scissors and cut it off. And she told him, "Doctor, you can't do that. You know that hasn't been sterilized." And he said, "It ain't nothing but a nigger. Don't worry about it." She developed an infection. The infection caused a head swell, and it was known at that time they called it spinal meningitis. She died by six. But his wife told my mother that she would make it up to her. If she became pregnant again, she would make sure that child lived. And that's me.
In a better
That's a clip from a short audio documentary piece produced by Grant Hull of Mormon. Grant, tell us what it's like. You're listening to something like 30 hours of audio, and then this story, you hear this. And you don't even hear it coming in his voice. I didn't. I was surprised. And I wonder what it's like for you to be listening to all this audio, and then he says that.
It was a surprise. And one thing that I notice in listening to Mr. Datcher's story is he slows down. The rest of the interview, he's talking kind of at a normal pace, but he starts with these long breaks. He's very intentional with his language. And that's something, there's information in those gaps. And that's something that I think perhaps radio could learn from oral history, is that instead of just trying to make things quick and short, even the ums that an interviewee offers, they carry information. And that's something that I try to honor in my editing. Is even Miss Carrie Stewart, the midwife that you heard, she says, "You know a lot," but she does it differently each time. And I try to keep those in because I think that they're important to her voice.
That's a clip from my interview in May with Grant Hull of Mormon when he joined us actually to talk about the Southern Oral History Program Sonic South Competition. He is here now. This is the most meta moment of our program where I'm talking to the producer about their favorite pick, which is them being a producer on the show on a different show.
Well, actually seeing both sides of the program was very interesting because what I enjoy about talk radio as opposed to the more produced sounds that I think dominate is that it is a natural way of speaking. It is conversation. There's a performance aspect to it, but when we talk to experts on air, they're not giving us canned answers. Our job as producers is to throw them a little bit off balance.
The trick is to actually ask, is not to trick anybody or to ambush them, but to ask something they know very well in a way that makes them reconsider what they know very well so that they have to answer it in a new way. I want one moment of pause. I want the finger to go to the lip and then say, "Oh, yeah, no, that's right. That's what I meant by that."
It's something that I've been watching carefully because we have to do these pre-interviews as well. Right. Before the interview goes on air, we have a whole process of talking to the guests beforehand and getting those answers, delving into someone's past experiences. A lot of that requires them to do reflection, and asking an expert or a performer to do that reflection with you over the phone can be a real challenge.
Well, you took those values of audio editing to the other extreme for us on one of our episodes of Movies on the Radio, which is a lot of fun, right?
I did a montage of movie quotes that I felt were really interesting and important, and I wove them all together.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a
damn sight. I'm gonna get medieval on your ass.
Why so serious?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Don't call me Junior.
Don't ever call me
doll.
Just shut up. You had me at...
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die!
No!
Offer me money.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's alive. It's alive. It's moving. It's alive.
Oh,
it's alive.
It's alive. This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have
what she's having with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
There is no spoon.
Is butter a carb?
Yes.
Get in my belly. Come on.
That was a montage of movie quotes made by Grant Hollab Moorman, one of our producers here on The State of Things, telling us about his favorite programs that he produced in 2019. I'm curious how you feel about, you know, some of the more newsy segments that you've had to produce on the show.
Yeah, and I don't have a journalistic training, and so this has been really interesting for me to cover political changes, to cover natural disasters in particular. Here in North Carolina, I came in right during hurricane season. And one of the examples that I got to really dive in and think deeply about was on Ocracoke Island. And we've been covering this topic extensively on this show and WUNC in general. And this was a really interesting moment where they had a debate on the island about whether to reopen a highway, whether to reopen the island overall to tourists for the Thanksgiving holidays. It's an opportunity to make money for the businesses, but the island was in disarray after Hurricane Dorian hit. And so for this program, I got to work with some local journalists. This is a physical paper on the island, the Ocracoke Observer. They discussed some of the challenges facing reconstructing an island when you rely on construction materials arriving via ferry, of finding housing for both the displaced residents and the construction workers who are rebuilding those homes. Here's a little bit from our conversation with Connie Leinbach.
There's mixed feelings. There are those businesses that say we can't sit around and play our violin forever. That's what one business owner told me. It's time to show how strong we are. We can spring back. Nothing is perfect. You can't make everyone happy. But staying closed is just going to prolong all parts of the recovery process, including the mental part. And I think the businesses that are pushing for this feel that way. And, you know, some of them can open and they need to make money. And we understand that definitely, you know, but also on the other hand, we do have we're like going out with our robe on, as one person said to me, because we have a lot of stuff that we're still dealing with here, cleaning up, repair. So it's just not going to be the same. Ocracoke, I just went by Edwards of Ocracoke. I know it's a specific place, but, you know, places are getting demolished.
Let's talk more about that. What do things look like? Talk about Edwards and what that is and what you saw and some of the other, where are we in the recovery?
Well, we have just begun. I mean, we had to clean out and get all these contractors here. UMCOR, that's the United Methodist Committee on Relief, Baptist on Mission, Samaritan's Purse, all kinds of interfaith groups came and helped muck out the place and take carpeting out and flooring out and drying it out, mitigating it. We need an army of construction workers here on the island right now. And it's, of course, as you can imagine, difficult to get things here with the access only by ferries. And some houses are going up. Many, Tom Paul can talk more about that. He's our county commissioner, about how many permits, how many houses are scheduled to be demolished. Many are unlivable, and the people that were living in them are either bunking in with friends and family or in rental houses. And so when the island reopens, don't know how many of those rental houses will be open. But the place, you know, has been for couple of weeks, as the debris gets removed, there's been a drywall boards, all kinds of stuff, furniture along the sides of the roads, and it's very heartbreaking as people's memories and lives is out there on the roads and trying to rebuild. While if you don't have a house, it's tough. But
Well, talk more about this debate over when to reopen, because, you know, the island does get a little bump, a kind of a postseason bump
on the Thanksgiving holiday, I understand. Maybe you can even tell us a little bit more about that so you can understand businesses saying, come on, let's get these roads open. Right. What about this business of sort of, but we've only, you know, we're walking around with our robes on. How much of the people who are pushing against that were saying, well, look, we our houses are wide open. I don't want visitors on the island. And how much of that was about, if we bring these people on now, it's going to impede the recovery efforts that are already underway. I mean, I wonder what the argument was or what the concerns are.
Yeah, I mean, all that's talked about is like, okay, if you open it up for visitors, I mean, are they going to take the spots that would normally go for construction materials coming over? It's a logistics challenge. I know Twig Rollins, he's in coordinating UMCOR here. They are going to bring, or they've already brought some storage containers to put building materials. They got building materials that they're going to bring over and like have a store. You know, it's a logistics challenge here. There are still some people that without electricity because the water was so high, it got into electric meters and they had to be pulled. You know, we don't have a playbook for this one. Wiz is a big one. You know, we've seen things. We've seen the devastation of Katrina and Houston and with Harvey, and now we're it. Although we're small, but we're just as devastated.
Connie Linebach of the Ocracoke Observer talking with us back in November about the debate over reopening the island to tourists after Hurricane Dorian. I am talking to Grant Hullab-Moorman, who is one of our producers and our newest producer. So what's next for us, Grant?
So there are lots of different parts of a disaster, and so that was kind of the post-disaster recovery period that we were talking about. Actually, before Dorian hit, we had a conversation focusing on disaster preparedness and communication among migrant workers and the Spanish-only speaking community here in North Carolina.
Especially with guest workers, they face a lot of challenges just even getting information about the disasters. Many times, these workers are recruited in other countries. They get in a bus, and then they're dropped off at the farm, and they don't realize where they are at. So they're unfamiliar with the geographic area. They don't know their address. Even if they have access to the news, it may say something about, let's say, Sampson County, but they don't realize they're there. So it's really hard for them to prepare. Sometimes it's even hard for them to get information because they don't have cell signal or because the information is often in English, in a language that they don't speak.
Do the farm owners have a responsibility to make this information available? I mean, how much should we be relying on them?
I don't think there's a law saying that they have to inform workers. But these farm workers are so isolated, they often depend on the employers to evacuate because they don't have their own transportation. We heard last year about the workers that were trapped in floodwaters at a labor camp. That was just one case that made the news, but we heard about more reports. And even today, we heard about an employer of guest workers who defied mandatory evacuation orders and refused to allow the employees to comply with it. And this happened even after the employer was requested to do so by government officials.
Tell us why undocumented workers might not reach out to government authorities when they're in danger.
Well, there's a lot of fear within the undocumented community. Whether everyone in the family is undocumented or whether it's a mixed status family, people are afraid to go to shelters and ask for help after the disaster. We worked with many families last year who actually qualified to apply for FEMA, but they were too scared to do so. And if I may add, just regarding the migrant labor camps, usually these camps could be like trailers or barrack-style housing or like an old farmhouse. They're really isolated and they're hard to find, especially when they're like next to the farm off the public roads. So under the Migrant Housing Act, there is no requirement that migrant housing providers use a 911 verified housing address, which is really dangerous for workers, not just during natural disasters, but during any time that they required an emergency service. So, for example, if you live in a trailer park where the trailers are unmarked and you need an ambulance because someone is having a heart attack, it will be really hard for you to describe your location to 911. This isolation And this hardship just to find the camps makes it even hard for us to do outreach sometimes.
That was Larissa Garzon, executive director of Episcopal Farmworker Ministry based in eastern North Carolina. On the day before Hurricane Dorian flooded the area back in September, I'm talking to producer Grant Hullab-Mormon. Grant, what stood out for you in that?
I think this is a really important segment for me to look back on because it didn't just broadcast these voices that I felt were important. It put people in the room that could listen to each other. And so in that room was Jessica Whitehead from the NC Office of Recovery and Resilience. It's a state government department that was created recently, planning for these long-term disaster preparedness and recovery. And she was listening to that interview with Larissa and hearing those voices. She immediately reached out to them. That's part of our job as journalists.
Oh, that sounds great. Grant, what's next?
We have to take a quick break. Let's go out with one of the bands I produced. This is the Thomas Taylor Plus Quintet. They're an intergenerational group continuing the conversation between jazz and hip-hop. We'll be right back. Here is Blue Crabs with a Side of Yak.
Where I'm from, small town, big lights, might drown from the years of the tears that been falling. What's my purpose? What's my calling? I'm going all in. Life is crazy. This the life that God gave me. So I praise thee, yea, save me, paved the way for me. But my hometown made me. Know who raised me? Single mother, welfare, no health care or wealth here. Why can't nobody come help here? Frustration, wish I was elsewhere. If you need it, I give more to you. Yeah, don't trip, man, it's more for you. Yeah, do you know what's in store for you? I'm a distressed denim, rocking retro Jordan, copping every single day I'm shopping, but I'm still broke. People dying while I'm sleeping, say I'm still woke. But I ain't out here in the streets and I'm just doing retweeting. I'm the one that caused depletion of the people you seeking. I'm consciously speaking, you probably need it. Cause your mind's been diluted and trees rootless. He's growing with no future. This that soul soother, for real. Cause I swear I've been burning for days. I'm just turning the page, I'm learning my ways. How does an amazing brother get stuck in a maze? Feel like I'm trapped and I'm running in place. I'm becoming a slave to my own thoughts. Can't lie, man, the system is odd. Let him free, but still treat him like he living inside. Black man out of prison, can't get close to a job. So we high off angel dust to get closer to God. Whoa.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, taking a look back at yet another year on The State of Things, today with producer Grant Hullab-Mormon, who's telling us about his favorite shows to produce on The State of Things. And when you started, actually, your first 6 weeks or so were while I was not the host. Anita Rao was here.
It's true. I showed up and you left right away. I'm not entirely sure if that was a coincidence.
No, but, it's just it was summer.
It was really exciting to be here while Anita was starting to introduce and develop the ideas for the Embodied series. I actually got to produce the first episode of that on sex ed curriculum. We'll take a listen to that in a minute. But I was curious, what's your perspective on seeing the larger trajectory of the show and the sort of topics and the sort of diversity of voices that we have on the show now versus, you know, 8 or 9 years ago?
Well, I think that's exactly what it does. It broadens the scope of The State of Things by having another voice, another host, do the kinds of the programs that we would, the sort of topics that we would do, but ones that she is very, Anita Rao is very, very passionate about and that I might have been interested in. So first of all, the kind of passion that she can bring to those particular topics is one thing, and the perspective as somebody who is not me, as somebody who is a woman, as someone who is younger, as someone who has had a different education. This is the way in which diversity really works well on a program and actually expands the scope. So that's my hope for the show, and I think that's pretty much what's happening. Why don't we listen to part of it, and then you as a listener can tell me, because this is part of Anita Rao's conversation about North Carolina's sex ed curricula. She's having that conversation with Elizabeth Finley, who is the director of strategic communications at an organization called Shift NC.
I'd like to learn a little bit more about parents and their role. In the past couple of years, we have had some vocal concerns from parents who don't like the curriculum that they're seeing in their kids' schools. Last year, there was a sex ed sit-out organized by parents who said this the curriculum was, quote, graphic gender-bending sex education. What concerns are you hearing from parents about the sex ed curriculum in their kids' classrooms?
Yeah, so we tend to hear more often from parents who want to be sure that their kids are getting content, or very often we hear that they assume that they're getting content, they just want it to be high quality. We view parents as an incredibly important component of the work that we do. And so in national surveys of of teens asking what are the most influential voices that they hear about sex, about their decisions about sex, about relationships, they always name parents as that most influential voice, ahead of media, ahead of peers. And so for us, thinking about the big picture of how do communities and schools keep young people healthy, like it just wouldn't be strategically sound of us to leave parents out of that equation. So one thing that we do when we launch new initiatives is we do a pretty full-scale needs assessment, and that includes gathering parent input. So we've done surveys both across the state and in local communities, asking parents what they want, and huge majorities want sex education that's essentially comprehensive sex education that includes both abstinence and information about condoms and contraceptives and things about healthy relationships.
Does teaching kids about sex encourage them to have sex?
There's a lot of research on that. And what it shows is that it absolutely does not encourage them to have sex. Young people don't look at sex education in the classroom or conversations about sex from their parents as a tacit endorsement of having sex. In fact, there's a good amount of research that shows that comprehensive sex education helps young people delay sexual initiation until later in life. So young people who get comprehensive sex ed wait longer to have sex. And that's in addition to the other benefits like lower teen pregnancy rates, better academic success, and a whole host of other benefits to comprehensive sex ed.
That was Elizabeth Finley of Shift NC talking about sexual education in North Carolina with host Anita Rao back in July. I'm here with Grant Hullab-Moorman, one of the producers of our show, talking about some of the episodes he has produced for us. What stood out for you?
I've got a question for you, Frank. I mean, how do you decide when a taboo topic should make it on air? I mean, when do you decide that something is too important?
No, I don't think anything is taboo. I think is it a topic that is generally interesting to people, and how are we going to approach it? And I don't think there's anything that we can't talk about. Nothing.
But is there a way that you would approach topics that might have that listeners might have a reaction to?
I mean, I'm hoping they're reacting to every one of them. The point is to be intelligent about them and not to gawk. So what you want to do is say, is this interesting? And how do we talk about this in an interesting way? And how do we understand that this is going to be uncomfortable for you and recognize that, but not kind of either yuck it up or pretend that this isn't sensitive? And so it requires a great deal of, I would say, interpersonal skill and emotional intelligence to know how to talk about a thing in a way that's intelligent and recognizes this is not an easy subject.
Absolutely. It's just difficult sometimes with radio in particular, because this is something that people tune into a lot of times without any sort of warning midway through the program, and they just have to dive into it. And one of the programs where I was thinking about this a lot, another embodied episode that I produced, was all about the gut and gut health. We talked to doctors, we talked to artists, and I was even able to weave in Lydia Green, who's a great researcher at the Duke Lehmer Center. One of the topics that kept coming up for me in the pre-interviews and in the research process were fecal microbial transplants. I'll let the experts explain.
Then we get on to fecal microbiota transplants. Okay, this is a technique that comes from ancient China, and it was called yellow soup. So I hope nobody's having soup for lunch right now. And it was fermented camel feces or infant feces, and it was consumed to treat any or numerous types of illnesses. And what it's primarily indicated for right now is Clostridium difficile infection, so recurrent infection. You can't get rid of the Clostridium difficile in humans, and it is causing a lot of diarrhea, it's causing inflammation, and it's very, very nasty. You take one FMT, 90% of people...
FMT is...
Oh, sorry, fecal microbiota transplant. And 90% of people are ultimately cured. It goes up to about 95% after two rounds of FMT. And this is really, really effective.
So basically what's happening is we are taking a sample of fecal matter from someone with a healthy gut.
Exactly.
And we are implanting it into someone who has things going on in the microbiome that are abnormal.
So if you take C. diff infection, for example, it's bloomed and it's taken over the ecosystem of the gut, and that's why it's causing all the troubles. But if you put back in a normal microbiota from a healthy individual and reestablish a healthy ecosystem, you go back to normal.
So, Lydia, you study lemurs, and you all have noticed also incredible things that can happen when you do fecal transplants in your lemurs. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the vets at the Duke Lemur Center have actually been doing fecal transplants since about the 1980s, is from what I understand from them. And it's just called poop soup out there. It wasn't called fecal transplant back in the day. But this understanding that lemurs who get pathogens in their gut and we give them antibiotics to help keep them healthy and get rid of the pathogen infection, that there might be some benefit from eating another animal's poop or eating your own poop from before you got sick. And this came from observations that lemurs will sometimes naturally eat poop. It's called coprophagy. And so often you'll see infants grab mom's poop and actually eat it. And we think that's a way that these animals naturally seed their own microbiome. And so when these animals were getting sick at the lemur center, they were giving them a poop soup, and the lemurs enjoy this. It's not like we have to force feed them. They are lapping it up. And we did a study looking at pathogenic infection and antibiotic use and these fecal transplants, and it looks like the microbiome returned to baseline diversity much faster as a consequence of having a fecal transplant versus not having a fecal transplant.
That's a clip from our show about the gut. Host Anita Rao is talking with Ian Carroll, assistant professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Lydia Green, a postdoctoral fellow at the Duke Lemur Center. And of course, doing science is a lot of fun, and doing research for science, I would guess, is part of the fun of doing this job, maybe?
Absolutely. I mean, I think just kind of nerding out over the phone with experts is one of the things that I enjoy most about this show. Being able to sit back and just feel like I am a student in that moment. And I get to ask all the questions that I was always too nervous to ask in class, and really probe the minds of these experts and ask them to break things down in a new way. Because I think a lot of times experts, especially scholars who might be used to writing books or writing articles for other scientists, asking them to reorient towards a more public perspective, change their language, break down some of this terminology that they might be using every single day. It's a lot of fun for me. And I get to learn about topics like fecal microbial transplants. Anita and I just had a blast diving into this one. Her dad is a gastroenterologist. And so we're reading scientific articles and going back and forth, watching videos and trying to understand how to explain these kind of nasty topics in a way that's just as interesting as we find it.
What's next?
So I got to bring in one of my favorite DJs from WKNC. I'm sort of a radio fiend, and I grew up on the lower end of the radio dial. I listened to a lot of KNC, XDU, XYC growing up. And really, these college radio stations that we have here totally changed my relationship with radio and music in general. And so it was a real pleasure to talk with Mir Iam, who was a DJ at KNC and then stepped it up to commercial radio at K97.5. She also runs the Carolina Waves Enterprise, which is a touring showcase across North Carolina that brings local artists together.
What kind of music were you playing then when you started?
On K97.5?
Yeah.
Whatever they had programmed.
Yeah.
You know, everything that I was doing at WKNC went out the window. From programming the music to, you know, the topics that we talked about, how long we talked. It was just like I was rogue on, you know, on WKNC doing what I wanted, and I had to totally just bring it in.
What was that like? I mean, on the one hand, you're getting a paycheck. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. On the other hand, wow, what a difference, huh?
It was, I mean, you know, starting out, I was just happy to get my foot in the door. So I'm like, all right, you want me to just talk for 1 second? That's fine. I don't care. I'm here.
Right.
You know, I've worked hard to get to this moment. Yeah. So it was very different. And actually, for probably about a year, I actually continued doing WKNC. I made sure it was okay to, but it was fine because it was a non-commercial station. So, you know, I still was able to have that outlet, have that platform, and then still be creative while I tried to figure out how I can fit my personality and bring who I was on WKNC to K97.5 in 30 seconds.
Are you feeling the pressure? Spotify, the streaming services, it seems to me, would provide the most pressure on radio stations. I might be wrong. Where is the pressure coming from?
I mean, there is pressure because, like you said, there are just so many options these days. And, you know, for me growing up, I would love to hear the DJ talk. A lot of the people that are, you know, the young kids now, they'll turn it off if they hear DJ talk because they have this playlist where nobody's talking and it's just continuous streams of music. Mm-hmm. So for radio to continue to be relevant, they're going to have to do more to stay in touch with the community and with local, and to just, you know, embrace the people that you don't know, that don't have a lot of money behind them. Because once you become a champion and a fan of the people, they're going to give you that support back.
That's Mirai M., CEO of Carolina Waves and host at K97.5. We talked to her back in September, one of Grant Hall of Mormon's favorites that he produced this year on The State of Things. Also interesting talking with Mira about radio in the age of Spotify. What are your reflections on that?
I mean, we live in an algorithm culture, and everyone's expecting to get recommended something that fits their taste perfectly, and that's not what radio is. I mean, our work as producers is to find something that appeals to people, but also pushes them into areas of discomfort, that introduces them to new topics. And so I think the job of radio is not to conform to Spotify, but to differentiate ourselves and kind of stick to that path and push ourselves further down it.
Grant, you have decided to take on a lot of the musical programming for our show. What do you like about that?
I mean, The State has so much music. We just did a retrospective of the different music of this year and of the decade in whole. And I was just blown away by the different ways we could pull from bluegrass, from gospel, from the different blues roots that exist in the Piedmont and eastern North Carolina. That blending and that rich heritage is just exciting to produce on a weekly basis and engage with artists who are coming from all over. I could talk about it for days, but our time is up. I'd like to go out with an artist from Wilkesboro, North Carolina. I went to Merlefest back in April, and I was just absolutely taken by his songwriting ability.
Just about to hear the music of Shay Martin, Love It. But first, we've been talking to Grant Hull of Mormon, a producer here on The State of Things. Anita Rao is another producer. Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus also. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia. Once again, the music of Shay Martin, Love It.
I've been walking for so long and no one knows. I took a trail and I don't know where it goes. I was lost, but something warms my heart. It was a red-winged blackbird in the stars. Maybe I could feel the warmth. Maybe the wilderness was still fighting. Maybe I was born from that fire. Maybe it was just heat lightning. I could feel those roots underneath my boots. And I could hear that wind whisper some old truth. Then at once the trees began to walk. They followed me and they listened as I talked. Feel the warmth. Maybe the wilderness was still fighting. Maybe I was born from that fire. Maybe it was just heat lightning. Maybe it was just heat lightning.